This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next on Plains FM, the Shetland and Orkney Connection, brought to you by the Canterbury Shetland and Orkney Society.
Played by Shetland band Homebrew, signal 8:30 p.m. the last Monday each month
for the Shetland and Orkney Connection, produced by the Canterbury Shetland and Orkney Society and broadcast on Plains FM 96.9,
either directly in Canterbury or streaming live globally on broadband,
or available for 3 months after the broadcast via podcast on the website www.plainsfm.org.nz.
And welcome to the March program in the series The Canterbury, Shetland and Orkney Connection. It's promoted by the Canterbury and Orkney Society and broadcast on Plains FM 96.9 at 8:30pm on the last Monday of each month. We're certainly well into autumn now, aren't we? Windier days,
colder nights and days,
more blankets on the bed,
and more frequent cuppas and coffees.
This is a time of great concern and anxiety since the terror attack on two Islamic mosques on Friday the 15th of March. So far, 50 people are dead and many injured, some critically.
On behalf of our society, my colleague today, Heather Craw, and I, Nan Anderson, offer heartfelt condolences to the bereaved. We also hope that the injured men, women, and children will recover physically and be helped to cope with the mental trauma that may haunt them for the rest of their lives.
The sudden death in January of Barbara Hughes, our colleague for well over 15 years, means that some changes in the team is more likely to follow. Nan and I can assure you that discussions are underway, and hope is that one or two people will find space in their busy lives to be involved in the program. We're hoping the debut of any new members can be Monday, April the 22nd, just 4 days after Anzac Day.
Heather and I, though, will start today with the group called Shetland's Young Heritage. In its heyday, nearly 40 years ago, it comprised a group of children aged 9 to 17, with most of them playing fiddle, three playing piano, one double bass player and one flautist, and a cluster of very supportive parents, grandparents and other relatives and friends backing the music to the max. The group was started by Dr. Tom Anderson, no relation to me, and travelled widely, especially in Canada and Scandinavia. Then, in 1986, the late Willie Hunter wrote a lovely, lively tune for the very first Heimferien to Shetland of those who migrated to all parts of the British Empire. We didn't call it the Commonwealth in those days, including New Zealand. And my parents, Charlotte and Thomas Anderson, were among the migrants who came in 1922.
One of Orkney's best known and most highly respected musicians has always been Kenny Rich from Dearness. You can imagine how delighted we were when his son, also a noted musician, brought his family to New Zealand and lived in Canterbury for quite some time.
There's no doubt in my mind that one thing among many that Shetland and Orkney have in common is the love of music and the performance skills that enhance everything they play and sing.
Kenny started his musical career on the traditional accordion, as did most Orcadian musicians, but Kenny was the first to introduce the electronic accordion to Orkney. His choice of music showed he had no prejudice, and he included tunes from Scandinavia and America, as well as from the expected Celtic traditions.
Let's listen now to a fantastic pipe tune from a sky fiddler written by a Scotsman in a prisoner of war camp during World War I, where he was unable to sleep because of a dripping tap. Thank you.
The next piece of music, Gloomy Winter, was written to a tune by Alexander Campbell, sometime before 1810. It describes what Orkney may go through every year while we are enjoying a beautiful late summer.
The tune apparently was used in the movie The Piano. You may not know that that movie was shot at Karekare in the North Island. It's a small coastal settlement west of the Auckland city centre, sandwiched between the Waitakere Ranges and a large black sand sunlit beach. This excerpt will give you some idea of the beautiful sounds in this piece.
Westland breezes blow, mang the bark so stunly show. The maver sings for cheerio. Sweet the crawflower's early bell. Dick's glenifers to eat down. Blooming like your bonny self. Come, my lassie, let us stray o'er Glenkillach's sunny brae. We'll blithely spend the golden day mid joy that's never weary. Lavrock's fan, the snow-white clouds, silver socks with downy birds, adorn the banks of Bredio. Round the sylvan fairy nooks, feathery brackens fringe the rocks, neath the brae the burny dew. Trees may bud and birds may sing, flowers may bloom and verdure spring, but joy to me they canna bring unless we my dear.
But Orkney's reputation rests on more than its music and musicians. In the world of exploration, John Rae was amongst the best, for it was he who found the Northwest Passage.
Heather, you've always been going to tell me more about John Rae, who did such a lot of exploring in Canada. He was an Orcadian, wasn't he?
Well, yes, he was. His parents came from Lanarkshire in Scotland, but he was born in Orkney on the 30th September 1813 at his family home, the Hall of Clestrain in Orpha, which is not far from the town of Strumness. He was the sixth child and fourth son, and there were three more children after him.
I imagine life was not easy in Orkney about the time he was born. So what sort of childhood did he have?
Well, he was rather fortunate, as his family were reasonably well off. For their education, the children had a private tutor. and although John would have preferred going to school and meeting other children, his father gave the boys two sailboats, which they learned to sail with proficiently, and sometimes raced the larger of the two boats with other boys from Strumness. John was also given a flintlock gun, which he used for hunting grouse, amongst other things, on the moors. He also enjoyed riding, trekking, fishing, and cliff climbing, and there are some good high cliffs around Orkney for that.
And there are plenty of good high cliffs in Shetland.
Learning all these skills stood him in good stead for his later roamings in Canada.
He did become a medical doctor, didn't he?
Yes, he did. When he was 16, he left Orkney for Edinburgh University to begin training as a doctor, but transferred to the Royal College of Surgeons and graduated from there as a surgeon at the age of 19.
Wow, that was young. What did John do once he had graduated?
Well, he returned to Orkney, where his father at the time was the Hudson's Bay Company's chief representative. He recruited men for the company. By going to Canada, Orkney men could earn twice the wages of an agricultural labourer in Orkney. John's two elder brothers had already gone to Canada, and John had quite a spirit of adventure, so decided to join the Hudson's Bay Company. He spent 10 years at Moose Factory, which is at the southern end of Hudson's Bay. He practiced medicine there and also oversaw the packing and preparation of furs for shipping to England. In his free time, he went hunting. This supplemented their food supply. He learned travel and survival skills from the Cree Indians. They also taught him how to make, maintain, and use snowshoes, and he came exceptionally good at using them. The Cree Indians also showed him how to use sleds for transport. From the Inuit, he learnt how to combat snow blindness, because they didn't have sunglasses in those days, how to cache food for future use, and how to construct snow shelters. And during those 10 years, he also did a course on surveying.
Didn't he also do some searching for the missing Franklin expedition?
Yes, he did three Arctic expeditions, surveying and looking for traces of Franklin's expedition. John Franklin, with 129 men, had left London in two ships in 1845 and had disappeared while searching for the Northwest Passage above Canada. On the third trip, Ray found a piece of wood and a part of a flagstaff containing a remnant of silk.
And Heather, do you know where those relics are now?
No, I don't actually, no. During his fourth Arctic expedition, he discovered that there was a Northwest Passage, a route successfully navigated by Roald Amundsen in 1903. Also on this trip, he met some Inuit who told him they had found a party of around 40 white men who had died of starvation on King Edward Island. There was evidence that they had resorted to cannibalism in a final desperate attempt to stay alive. Franklin's men had tried to survive in impossible conditions without adequate knowledge of the Arctic.
Oh, I bet John Franklin's wife, Lady Jane, was not too happy about the mention of cannibalism.
No, she was not. John had sent his reports to the Admiralty in London. He had prepared a sensitively worded account of his findings to be released to the public, but for some reason the full report was published. Lady Jane was furious and enlisted the help of some of her influential friends to discredit John. One friend, Charles Dickens, and yes, it was the Charles Dickens, the writer, used his popular magazine Household Words to cast doubt on the Inuit story, and they were vilified as savages, liars, and murderers. He also denounces John. Lady Jane also attacked John, stating that Englishmen of all people would not resort to cannibalism. He was eventually awarded the £10,000 reward offered for news of the fate of the Franklin expedition, and this he shared with his men.
After all this denunciation, what happened to John after this?
Well, he continued his rugged work of surveying and worked on a route for a telegraph link from Britain to Canada via Iceland and Greenland. In 1865, he surveyed Red River to Victoria for another telegraph link from America to Russia. When he retired, he had mapped 1,755 miles of Arctic coast, either on foot or by boat. It was said of John that he could outwalk, outrow, outshoot, outsurvive every other man. He seemed to have thrived in the cold north of Canada. On one of his trips north, he and his men built a stone shelter, but it proved to be unsuitable as it was freezing cold inside. And on a visit to some Inuit friends in their snow shelter, John was surprised to find his clothes and beard thawing out. It was then the Inuit showed him how to make a snow house. John liked to read, and sometimes he would have to thaw out his book by putting it under his clothes next to his skin.
Oh, my goodness. Now, the most important question, did John ever get married?
Yes. He was 47 when he married Catherine, or Kate, Thompson in 1860. He died on 22nd of July 1893 in Kensington, London, and his wife took his body back to Orkney.
I've been to Orkney, I've been inside the Kirkwall Cathedral, and I've seen the large memorial to him inside. Is this where he's laid to rest?
No, he's actually buried along the back fence of the cathedral, and it is well marked with a headstone in the shape of a cross. And yes, there is a large memorial to him inside the cathedral. They have him lying under a buffalo hide, wearing Inuit muklooks, with an open book and musket by his side. Parts of the memorial are quite smooth from the touch over the years of many hands. At the time, John was never given the recognition he deserved for the work he did and the discoveries he made. Many of the other Arctic explorers were ignited, but not John. There is a Friends of John Ray Society, and they have been working hard with some success on getting him the recognition that he justly deserves. They are also working to keep John's family house in Orkney restored. I have only very briefly touched on the life of John Ray, but if you are interested in learning more about this fascinating explorer, read the book Fatal Passage by Ken McGugan.
Nearly up, and what could be a more appropriate music gem to be the backing for our final words than Sophie's Lullaby, composed by Ali Bain and arranged by Phil Cunningham. Ali tells the story about his third and youngest daughter, Sophie. She was such a vivacious, energetic wee thing that the very first time he played the lullaby to her, she fell fast asleep.
Let us know if you know of anyone who has recently visited Orkney and or Shetland, or intends to visit these island groups fairly soon. New listeners are always interested to know that we welcome visitors around the studio table with its central microphone. It's a sharing and learning experience for programmers as well.
One aspect of program broadcasting has changed from the pattern we were all used to last year. Might be a good idea to mark these dates in your diaries. The March program, as you know, is at 8:30 p.m. on the last Monday of the month. It's now repeated at noon 2 Mondays later. That'll be April the 8th. The April program will be at 8:30 p.m. on the last Monday of April and will be repeated at noon 2 Mondays later. That'll be May the 13th. In the meantime, beware of the measles bogey and stay close to home if you don't feel 100% fit. Bye for now.
And make sure you and your family keep well and safe until we talk to you again in April. Cheerio.